Please be seated. Our first case this morning is United States against Torrey. Counsel for the defense.
Thank you, Your Honor. As a preliminary matter, I'd like to respectfully inform the court that appellant's brief on page 10 originally states that there was no DOD directive on wiretapping. However, it came to the attention of the appellate defense counsel late last night, and moved to prompt to inform the appellate government counsel that there actually is a DOD wiretapping instruction. We both believe that it's not relevant to the argument that has been granted for issue today, and appellant is going to be filing a motion today to amend the brief.
We'll consider that filing when it's made. Thank you.
Thank you.
Could you pull the microphone a little bit closer?
There we go. Absent any further questions, may it please this court, my name is Lieutenant Anthony Yim, and I represent the appellant center technician, First Class Petty Officer Dennis Torrey, United States Navy. With the court's permission, I respectfully request 5 minutes of time for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you. I believe Mark Twain perhaps accurately summarized the position when he famously said, "It ain't what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It's what you know for sure that just ain't so." Using Mark Twain's words, the government is consistently arguing that appellant's interpretation just ain't so. However, because of the lack of prior case law on this subject, and because of the lack of statutory and regulatory guidance on this matter, appellant urges that an ambiguity exists within the rule, and that ambiguity should be interpreted in favor of the appellant. Absent this court's directions, appellant would like to bring 3 issues for discussion. The first issue is that appellant believes that Military Rule of Evidence 317A is ambiguous, as it does not delineate between federal and state statutes. And if time, appellant would like to highlight, even if this court adopted the government's statutory construction of a jus in generis, it would still fail. And finally, that appellant may properly preserve this issue for appeal. Moving on to appellant's primary point, that Military Rule of Evidence 317A is ambiguous as it does not delineate between federal and state statutes. Appellant would urge this court to first examine appellant's interpretation of the rule and see if it is contradicted by the plain language of the rule.
Counsel, do you agree that the language that we need to be looking at is that the language in 317A must be excluded under a statute applicable to members of the armed forces?
Yes, Your Honor.
And do you agree then the question that for us to decide is which law determines when evidence must be excluded?
Yes, Your Honor. Which evidence applies when the drafter said must be excluded? Yes, Your Honor.
Which law determines when evidence must be excluded?
Yes, Your Honor. Which evidence determines when evidence must be excluded? That's correct.
And as a matter of federal preemption, isn't it the federal statute that determines when evidence must be excluded?
Yes, Your Honor. However, I don't think that inhibits appellant's argument. We believe the rule interprets it so that even though we recognize preemption and that federal law will always control over state law, the rule is not drafted as such. The rule instead, appellant argues, looks to both jurisdictions, federal and state.
No, it says when it must be excluded, and you've agreed with me that the law that it's federal law that would determine when it must be excluded, and the drafter's analysis is consistent with that interpretation because it talks about the Constitution and applicable federal statute.
Actually, Your Honor, while I understand your point, that's not exactly what we agreed to, what we conceded. We conceded that it must be excluded pursuant to the law. Under Hawaii's state law, this evidence must be excluded.
Why isn't this a question of federal law?
Because, Your Honor,
through operation of Title III of the Omnibus Safe Streets Act.
Yes, Your Honor. It's not a question of purely federal law because the rule as written looks to both jurisdictions.
But why do you have to rely on that? Why don't you just, why don't you address 2515 and 2511 2B? Don't they reference state law through federal law?
It does reference state law through federal law. However, Your Honor.
Is it your position that you only prevail on your issue if we jump right to state law?
Yes, Your Honor.
Rather than through operation of federal law?
Yes, Your Honor.
You're conceding that?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe the Federal District Court in the Ninth Circuit has ruled that under federal law, considering federal wiretaps in Hawaii, concerning federal wiretaps in Hawaii, that even though it's a violation of state law, under 2511, then it's valid. However, we're not operating under 2511. We're operating under Military Rule of Evidence 317A. 317A does not delineate.
2511 is a statute that is applicable to members of the armed forces?
Yes, Your Honor. However, we'd also argue that Hawaii state law is applicable to members of the armed forces as well.
Independent of federal law?
Yes, Your Honor. However, it is subservient to federal law. The rule does not, when we look at federal jurisdiction, we see if there's a preemption, if the rule is preempted by the language of the statute.
Doesn't the drafter's analysis of 317, in discussing 317A, state that the area of interception of communications is governed, quote, by the Fourth Amendment applicable federal statute, DOD directive, and regulations prescribed by the service secretaries? And then it goes on when it talks about 317C and adopts basically the same construction. 317A specifically requires exclusion of evidence resulting from noncompliance with 317C only when exclusion is required by the Constitution or an applicable statute insofar as violation of a regulation is concerned, and then it cites some cases.
Yes, Your Honor. If I may briefly address that, first of all, the statute, the rule itself says statute. It does not say federal statute. Second of all, the analysis, while you are correct, the words that you recited, I would like to also highlight the analysis. It says that this area is incredibly fluid, incredibly complex and fluid, and in addition, it says that preceding this, for example, it says at present. That the nature of at present.
Are you suggesting that the state law has changed since the drafter's analysis was written?
No, Your Honor. I think that it's that the drafter's intended this, that this list was not meant to be exclusionary, that we can add state law to that example as well as take it away.
Would you agree that the military rules of evidence are there to make things simple and they're in part laid out specifically to make things simple in a very widely dispersed system, correct? They should be easily understood.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I would disagree with that. I find that there is incredible complexity within the military rules of evidence.
So you don't think that there's any intent by laying out specific rules of evidence to allow there to be some structure within court-martial system?
I think there is, Your Honor. However, I would also point you to other federal military rules of evidence, which incorporates state principles and state laws.
Well, but isn't, you know, we're dealing with, number one, a uniform code of justice here. Now, of course, the uniformity is as between the services as opposed to what went on pre-50.
Yes, Your Honor.
But aren't we also dealing with a set of evidentiary rules that are intended to be nationally, internationally uniform throughout the armed services? And wouldn't it be illogical to import state law into something that's supposed to be nationally uniform and is carried out in a wholly federal fashion with unless you have an explicit reference to state law?
Yes, Your Honor. If we may briefly address that, I respectfully, obviously respectfully disagrees with that contention. In fact, we have, while there might be a policy argument for uniformity, we clearly do not have uniformity within the Uniform Code of Military Justice. You see, look, I would respectfully point this Court's attention to Military Rule of Evidence 413 and 414, which specifically incorporates state law for
purposes. That's exactly my point. They want to incorporate state law, they say so. 317 doesn't say anything about state law.
Yes, Your Honor. It doesn't say anything, but it doesn't exclude it either. In fact,
is it your argument then that unless it's explicitly excluded, it's incorporated?
Yes, Your Honor.
In a consistent federal system?
Well, Your Honor, I would again respectfully point this Court's attention to Military Rule of Evidence 311 and 501, which specifically do delineate federal district court and incorporate the federal system exclusively. I think, Your Honor, the way the rule is written is ambiguous. In fact, we see in the analysis of the rule, it was purposely meant to be ambiguous.
Counsel, do you agree with this proposition that the statements at issue or the communications at issue would be admissible under 18 U.S.C. 2511
to be? Yes, Your Honor.
So if we have a federal statute that says that they're admissible, and we have a state statute that says that they may not be admissible, which prevails?
Well, Your Honor, respectfully.
Because it cannot be both.
No, I would respectfully answer your question. I believe the Hawaii State statute does say this evidence is excluded explicitly. And second, I would say that the way the rule is written, I think, while state law never trumps federal law, the way the rule is written, it looks for an objection either in state jurisdiction or federal jurisdiction.
But can you explain to me how it will be the case that the state law is not trumping the federal law if it's admissible under the federal law and it's not admissible under the state law? And you're saying that the state law will prevail. How is that not trumping the federal law?
Again, I think I understand your position. I think it just goes to the definition of trumping.
I don't have a position.
I would believe that trumping, if you define trumping as one law prevails, then yes, I believe the state law would quote-unquote trump federal law. However, I believe the way the rule is written, it looks for an objection either in federal law or in state law. So state law isn't trumping federal law on the basis of the fact that it's state law itself. Instead, the way the federal rule is written, Appellant argues, it looks for an objection to either state law or federal law. Once finding an objection, and then it becomes federal law. So federal law technically trumps federal law.
I understand your position, counsel.
Thank you, ma'am.
Do you have any case sites for the proposition that a rule in the MRE written in general terms without an explicit incorporation of state law in fact does so? Have we ever held that?
No, I was not able. However, I was not able to find such a rule for military rule of evidence. However, when this court has addressed an ambiguity within the criminal statute under Thomas, Shelley, and Roe, you have interpreted that ambiguity in favor of the service member. When this court has found an ambiguous legislative intent, this court, such as in Busick, this court has interpreted the ambiguity in favor of the service member. Here, we have a rule that was purposely left ambiguous.
What evidence do you have?
Purposely?
Your Honor, I would point this court's attention to the third line of the analysis, which says, in view of the situation, it is preferable to refrain from codification.
That just has to do with keeping it out of statute and putting it in regulation because it's more flexible in regulation. I don't think that gets you anywhere. That's a statement that we don't want to codify this in statute.
Well, it can be interpreted likewise as we don't want to codify this in regulation, and we don't want to codify this in a rule. Again, Your Honor, I respectfully direct this court's attention to the plain language of the statute, which simply does not contradict the appellant's interpretation. We have other rules in the Federal Military Rules of Evidence which specifically delineate federal district court. In light of such ambiguity, the government is forced to argue that there should be a uniform policy. However, such uniform policies are not consistent plain text of the rule.
Counsel, it appears that you're arguing plain text of the rule, and you're also arguing ambiguity. So why don't we see if you can choose between the two as to which canon of statutory interpretation you'd like us to apply here.
Sure, Your Honor. To elucidate appellant's argument, we see that appellant's interpretation of the statute, of the rule, is not contradicted by the plain meaning of the rule. And I believe I urge this court to start its analysis at that point. Is appellant's interpretation facially invalid? Appellant argues no, and then argues.
Because so you're making plain language argument, not an ambiguity argument?
Well, Your Honor, it's technically. I mean, it's technically both, Your Honor, because I would urge this court to start at to see if the plain language of the rule contradicts appellant's interpretation. If it does, then there's obviously no argument. However, since it does, we can see that the reason it's not contradicted is because the rule is ambiguous. We cite for an ambiguity because the drafters of the rule have made this rule ambiguous.
And in that context, whether it's ambiguity or plain text, do we look at the purpose of the rule and its underlying context to determine its meaning?
Yes, Your Honor.
And in Article 36 of the UCMJ, it states that the President shall apply the rules that are applied in federal district court in criminal trials, unless he determines that to be, insofar as he determines practicable. So is it the defense position that the president has decided in this case that it is not practicable to apply the rule that's applied in federal district court, in which case the evidence would be admissible?
Yes, Your Honor, because if the president, again, I would respectfully point this court's attention to Military Rule of Evidence, I believe, 101, which does allow, as we see in the plain language of the rule, it defaults to the federal district rule, fixing the federal district court rules. And then, if not contradicted by those federal rules, we have an adoption of common law rules.
Right. So to achieve the result that the defense wants here, we would have to reach the conclusion that the president has decided that members of the armed forces should receive a protection under state law that's not available to other citizens of the United States facing identical criminal charges in a federal district court trial.
I believe that is an application of the rule that I would urge this court to adopt. I believe that since this
So your answer is yes, that's what the president intended.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank
one
you.
Of the intentions, because as we see, this rule would not apply to military law enforcement personnel. This rule will not apply to federal law enforcement personnel. Instead, we have a rule that solely governs third-party conduct. That third-party conduct, essentially vigilantism, is operating in a jurisdiction that prohibits this type of infringement upon the privacy interests of a resident in their state.
Can I just check again? Your ambiguity comes from the fact that the word federal does not appear in front of statute?
Yes, Your Honor. And it also doesn't say federal district court.
In your interpretation of Hawaii law, the video and the audio is the same?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe it is.
So what about the fact that, which was the one that he knew was happening?
That was the videotape, Your Honor.
And he comes home every day and submits himself to this process?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why isn't that some form of consent?
Because the military judge made a finding of fact on the record that this was a non-consensual recording, in the sense that he wasn't able to object to this recording even if he wanted to.
But and yet he came home every day and subjected himself to the recording.
He was unable to object to the recording, Your Honor, I believe is the finding of fact, and the government cannot show a contrary finding of fact that is clearly that.
Was he being physically compelled to return home each day?
To return home each day? No, sir.
Mm-hmm.
But again, as we take a look at Hawaii law, we see that it is a codification of their common law in the sense that I believe Article 1, Section 7 of the Hawaiian Constitution guarantees the right of privacy. We see that Hawaii Statute 803-46 allows this evidence, mandates that this evidence be suppressed.
Getting back to Judge Efron's point from earlier, if this precise scenario had taken place and was being adjudicated in the federal district court in Hawaii, do you agree that the evidence would be deemed admissible despite the Hawaii statute?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that every circuit court of the United States that has addressed the same issue would have found that it was admissible despite contrary state law?
Yes, Your Honor. However, I would also encourage this court to understand that there would be some acts, again, according to Military Rule of Evidence 413, that would be prescribed under one state that would be admissible, that when we look to another state would not be so prescribed. So we have disparities within the military rules of evidence, Your Honor, according to state by state. We have different authorities as to recognize authority to search and execute a warrant under Military Rule of Evidence 315. The military rules of evidence allow state by state differentials in their analysis.
So just so that I understand from your brief, you're grounding this in the service member's right to privacy, is that correct, and that we go with whatever right of privacy is greatest, the state or the federal?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so a service member's right to privacy will vary depending on the vagaries of his detailer, where he or she may end up being stationed?
Well, I guess that's the, yes, Your Honor, to answer your question, yes, Your Honor, because it is the consequences of dual sovereignty that would exist in the United States. Again, we have conduct that would be prescribed in one state might not be illegal in another state. So, again, this is not pertinent or limited to this exact rule. We have many such rules. But we incorporate state laws for purposes of the assimilation clause. So we assimilate state law crimes. Certain state laws have prescribed certain conduct and other states haven't. So perhaps it is up to the vagaries of the detailer system. But again, that is the consequences of living in a country with two sovereigns. The citizens of Hawaii.
Is that the consequence of a country living in dual sovereigns or under the Supremacy Clause? Is that the consequence, for example, of 413 or the Assimilative Crimes Act, of a specific decision by those empowered to make the laws or rules to incorporate state law?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. Again, we see that the federal law, we can interpret this federal law to have incorporated the state law. Again, in the sense that it does not say federal statute applicable to members of the armed forces, it could easily do so, as pointed out. It could easily say as applicable to members of the armed forces in federal district court. That also would have would eliminate opponent's interpretation. Instead, we're left with a simple rule that opponent believes is ambiguous simply because the president failed to add additional terms.
Would you address the government's points on issue preservation and the law of the case?
Yes, sir. For issue preservation, Your Honor, we believe that the appellant has properly preserved this issue for appeal. That trial defense counsel, I believe, at Exhibit 20, objected via Military Rule of Evidence 317.
But wasn't the substance of his objection a different construction?
Well, Your Honor, it actually was a similar construction. It's pretty technical, but they were arguing an exception to the exception to the federal statute 2511.
He was arguing the construction that you have now abandoned, right?
Yes, Your Honor. He was still arguing.
Well, then how did that preserve the issue?
Because
you abandoned that construction.
He was arguing that federal law should adopt the state law. He was arguing at the trial court that because it is illegal under Hawaiian statutory code, it should not be adopted. And that's exactly the same argument that Appellant is presenting here today. Because it is illegal under Hawaii State Code, it should not be adopted as proper evidence. In fact, the military judge at 392 issues a ruling that is broad enough to cover Appellant's arguments, stating that this court is not persuaded that MRA 317 will provide service members stationed in jurisdictions in which there is two-party consent would enjoy greater protection than military members stationed in one-party consent. Much like Judge Ryan's question.
Okay, and would you address why isn't the holding below the law of the case since you didn't appeal it years ago?
And that was an interesting argument. Your Honor, we did file this exact same issue with the lower court. And we believe we filed the exact same issue before the lower court, before a final decision was issued in the case before the lower court. I believe what the court was referencing in the law of the case is the fact that the unappealed issue, meaning that state law, that 2511, it requires that this evidence be excluded. We abandoned that argument at the lower court.
Well, now, wait a minute. You're trying to have it both ways. You just said that you've preserved the issue on appeal with regard to issue preservation because your objection was close enough to what you're saying now. And now are you saying the reverse, that what's the law of the case is the 2511 issue, not this issue?
Your Honor, what we're saying is that we properly filed this exact argument, in fact, the exact same, almost word for word of the brief, with the lower court before they issued the decision. So we don't believe the law of the case doctrine would apply. We properly objected at the proper time.
Which decision, counsel, the first decision or the second decision?
Excuse me, the second decision, Your Honor.
Okay, but in the second decision, I think they say in the footnote they're referencing your failure to appeal their ruling on this issue in their first decision.
Right, no four.
Yes, Your Honor, we don't believe that we filed the issue before the lower court adjudicated this finally. It was properly raised before the lower court. Admittedly, it did come after the remand. But it was properly adjudicated before the lower court in a timely manner.
Well, but no appeal was taken on this issue after when after the CCA issued its initial decision 3 years ago.
We don't believe that's a decision. I believe that's a remand order, Your Honor. We believe that review had not been completed by Article
15. Okay, you're saying it isn't final for purposes of appellate review?
Yes, Your Honor. It was not final because they invited appellate counsel to file additional arguments. Therefore, we don't believe the law of the case applies. However, if this court doesn't believe that that's a proper lodging of the objection, we would also, again, since the exact same argument was presented at trial court at the first argument of the lower court, and therefore the Brotherman was the same, I believe this court in Brandel, Sutton Fontenot, stated that when all parties appreciate the substance of a defense objection, a military judge has a full opportunity to consider it, where it should not apply. This court, I believe, has never held particularity or such specificity that it overrule opponent's proper objection of the case. Objection of the rule of law. I see that my time has expired.
We have an opportunity on rebuttal.
Thank you, ma'am.
Counsel for the government.
Your Honors, and may it please the Court, my name is Major Brian Keller. I represent the government. The government believes that appellant is trying to have it both ways in the law of the case and waiver. However, the government believes that the government also wins on both those issues. Appellant failed to object on the state law grounds at trial. The lower court in 2004 ruled in favor of the government and resolved this issue on 18 U.S.C. 2511 grounds in 2004, and then appellant failed to appeal that. So appellant, the government wins on both issues, the government believes. The question before this court is whether Military Rule of Evidence 317 incorporates state statutes. The government's answer is no. First, appellant waived this issue again, and then the law of the case issue. Second, I'll discuss that even if waiver or law of the case does not apply, the plain language of the statute and the rules of statutory construction lead to the conclusion that the rule does not integrate or incorporate state statutes, particularly considering how state and federal laws elsewhere in the code, or rather the rules, are referred to. As well as the evidence and the analysis given about the President's intent. And finally, if this Court interprets the rules the way appellant wishes it to, absurd results would obtain.
Counsel, let me ask you a question. If under Military Rule of Evidence 317A, would the result in this case be different if there was not a federal statute that made the evidence admissible?
The government believes no, Your Honor. It was dicta in the lower court, I think conceivable by the lower court, that the Hawaiian statute would prohibit this evidence. However, even if the Hawaiian statute prohibits the evidence, which the government doesn't believe it does, in federal court, still the U.S. constitutional analysis that would apply and would allow this evidence in. I believe that the Hawaiian statute says that it prohibits installation in any place without consent of the person or persons entitled to privacy therein. That invocation of privacy requires a U.S. constitutional analysis of what privacy means, U.S. Constitution as applied to members of the armed forces, or however the language usually goes in the military rules of evidence. So therefore, no, it still would be admissible because we get back to federal law when that Hawaiian law is applied at court-martial, if it was.
Okay, but I think I'm asking a slightly different question, which is, if there was no federal statute on point, there was no federal statute that talked about the admissibility of evidence like this, none, and all we had was a state statute that said it would not be admissible, in your view, would that then fall under 317A or not? And if not, why not?
Your Honor, if it said that it would not be admissible, and assuming that the 317 is trying to incorporate state law, which the government doesn't believe it does, if it was incorporating it, yes, it would be not admissible. But that's not what 317 is doing. 317 is not incorporating state law. And that's not what we have here. That's not the case we have here, because again, the statute is just saying you can't install in a private place without respecting the right to privacy of the persons therein. And again, you get back to federal law. And the government's position is, of course, that 317A is not incorporating state law. There's a plain language issue, again, which is 317 says evidence must be excluded at court-martial. And, of course, no state law can require that evidence be excluded at court-martial. And the words court-martial, sometimes they're left out. The words as applicable to members of the armed forces, sometimes they're left out. The word U.S. before Constitution is sometimes left out, but clearly the sovereign is clear throughout the military rules of evidence. We're talking about courts-martial at the forum. We're talking about U.S. Constitution, and we're talking about service members at court-martial. And here it seems like the word federal is left out.
Well, the rule incorporates Rule 311.
I'm sorry, what?
The Rule 317 incorporates Rule 311, which deals with the reasonable expectations of privacy of service members. So, as I understand the structure of the rule, it's not that the state law would require, as a procedural matter, the exclusion of the evidence in a court-martial, but rather the issue is whether state law is evidence of a reasonable expectation of privacy of service members who reside in that state. So I wonder if you could address that question, and that is, to what extent does the state law establish or not establish a reasonable expectation of privacy of members who reside in that state?
Well, Your Honor, the government believes that it doesn't establish any reasonable expectation of privacy within the court-martial context, because again, there's a supremacy issue of U.S. law, or the preemption issue of U.S. law governing service members at courts-martial. We look to the U.S. Constitution, and then we look to the federal district courts, and then we look to the common law, again, to find out how that privacy right applies to courts-martial. And here, clearly, those are the different sources that we look to. We don't look to state law. And by the plain language of the statute, by the analysis, the drafter's analysis, which says that federal law, DOD directive, regulation, et cetera. So we're not looking to state law at all, Your Honor.
So your view is that as a matter of federal law, state law can never establish a right of privacy on the part of a U.S. citizen unless it's expressly referenced?
Well, unless it's incorporated expressly, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. Appellant tries to argue that the rule of lenity be applied in this case. However, it's very clear that the rule of lenity applies only to penal statutes, and these are not penal statutes. There is case law that says that the rules of evidence are essentially procedural issues and not penal statutes. Clearly, they're not penal statutes. But again, the rule of lenity applies to penal statutes whether an appellant doesn't know what crime it is he's going to be convicted or he could be convicted of. And that's not the case here. We simply have a rule of evidence. And instead of an issue where he might incur liability, rather we have an issue where a constitutional issue might arise. And the rule of construction is that where a constitutional issue might arise, that should be avoided in favor of a more strict analysis of the rule. And here we have the construction in the rules of courts-martial, in the military rules of evidence, which is always followed where federal law is invoked. So we have two different indications of the sovereign. First is federal law, and second is state law. And as referenced in the brief, there's the federal sovereign language, which is referenced in 311 also. And that the construct that's always followed is the Constitution of the United States, number one, or two, the rules, an act of Congress applicable to trials by courts-martial. 402 follows the same construction, Constitution of the United States, or any act of Congress applicable to members of the court, members of the armed services.
That was going to be my next question, and that is to see if you have an explanation for the difference in language between 402 and 317. 402 expressly using the term act of Congress applicable to members of the armed forces, and 317 not using that term act of Congress.
No, Your Honor. The government has no good explanation for that. However, I think the answer is, in reference to all the different rules which have slight variations, you have 311 and 402. One says applicable to members of the armed forces. The other one says applicable to trials by courts-martial. Those are all implied, and they need not necessarily be said. Certainly, it would be more facially clear if that language was in there. 501 is another one. The privilege is one. Privilege may only be claimed if required by the Constitution to supply members of the armed forces. I think it's beyond cavil. They don't mean the state constitutions. They mean the U.S. Constitution, even though they don't say the U.S. Constitution.
Right, but here we have, between 402 and 317, the same phrase, applicable to members of the armed forces.
Yes, Your Honor.
And one uses the phrase, act of Congress, and the other one does not. What should we do in terms of principles of statutory interpretation where the president in the same body of law, the rules of evidence, refers expressly to an act of Congress in one rule and doesn't refer expressly to an act of Congress in another one, where the same concepts involved, that is, what gets excluded and what gets admitted.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, I think different rules of statutory interpretation apply. I think first, there's the appellate defense counsel pronounced it better than I will, but there's Judum Generis rule, which suggests that general phrases which follow specific phrases should be informed by the prior specific phrases. And here we have, in 317, the Constitution of the United States. It's clear what the sovereign is there. And that's followed by the second phrase, which is statutes applicable to members of the armed forces. Completely clear that it means the United States statutes applicable to members of the armed forces. They don't say that. We're in a United States court, a federal court. We're talking about courts martial. We're talking about trials of members of the armed forces. That language sometimes is implicit, but it's absolutely clear to most reasonable readers what that means. And also, of course, the analysis which this court in Taylor this year found was strong evidence of what the drafters meant in Taylor. As in Taylor, here we have the language of the drafters, which says, you know, federal statutes, DOD directives, again, all the federal sovereign. And here that should inform this course analysis. Certainly, there is Hawaiian law that was extant at the time that language was written. Certainly, in this version of the Manifer course martial, there is state law, but they're only listing federal law. They're not listing state law in the analysis. 102 also, Judge Ryan asked the question about simplicity. 102 suggests that fairness, delay should be avoided, promotion of growth and development of the law, and the assertion of the truth. Certainly application of all those rules in 102 hew towards the government. Fairness is found in consistent application, not in 50 different sovereigns. Or possibly more if appellant's analysis is followed to its natural conclusion. Any statute applicable to members of the armed forces could be a service member in Afghanistan where perhaps there's no SOFA, and we have rules of evidence which might be different than the United States rules of evidence. We have a trial at Bagram Air Base, and we have a totally different sovereign's rules of evidence being incorporated. It doesn't make any sense, and that's not what, certainly we're not the, not what the President intended. Delay, if the military judge and trial counsel and defense counsel have to deal again with 50 different sovereigns, possibly foreign sovereigns. If you have a service member who's got dual citizenship, he claims that his mother country's or his other country's statutes are applicable to him. Does that get incorporated also here? Development of the law of evidence with an eye towards truth and just determination, certainly that's hampered if we have different sovereigns involved. Again, Article 36, of course, Henry B. Rumsfeld, there's no citation of the impracticality of having consistent application of the law. I think that certainly applies to this case. Henry B. Rumsfeld obviously is a but-see. Rule 101, which follows Article 36, which says, again, if not prescribed, the courts martial should apply first the rules of evidence generally recognized in the trials by courts U.S. district courts, and second, evidence common law. Of course, in common law, there was no exclusionary rule, so this evidence would come in no matter what in common law, if that's what gets referred to after the rules of the U.S. district courts, which, again, would favor the government by, I think, a large body of case law.
Would you respond to appellate defense counsel's construction on the issues of issue preservation and the law of the case?
Yes, Your Honor. Appellant only at trial objected on the basis of the 18 U.S.C. 2511, and he therefore waived the state law issue. However, if I may, let me put in for a second. The military judge, on page 392 of the record, did answer the question without appellant having raised it specifically, and said they declined to adopt the argument of defense, which isn't really what he argued, but that in this case, the military rules of evidence and federal statute should be preempted by the Hawaii state law on this issue. So there, he answered the question. Appellant didn't appeal that, and that became law of the case. He appealed only the 18 U.S.C. 2511 issue. He didn't make this novel argument that he made in 2006. So I think that appellant's trying to have it both ways, but I think that works for the government because not only did he not make that objection at trial, but there was a ruling. The court in 2004 answered basically that preemption applies in this case. The federal government has made federal rules of evidence, military rules of evidence, federal statute 2511, which governs this case, and therefore state law simply doesn't apply here. And again, I think the rule of lenity shouldn't apply in this case because it's not penal.
So what's the extension of that argument? So if there's a Fourth Amendment objection and it gets appealed, do you have to put all your theories on the table at that time?
Well, Your Honor, it should be the specific grounds of objection. And the government was
asked, folks weren't on notice what the issue was here, that it wasn't in the Hawaii statute in play in some manner. They might have thought that the real issue was what Afghan law applied.
Well, yes, Your Honor, if appellant came on later and said that it was, in fact, the Afghan incorporated.
Right, that would clearly be waiver. But yes. What about this case where everybody was on notice that the issue was how did federal and state law apply, if at all, in this case?
Well, yes, Your Honor.
And they're arguing for a very specific, I don't want to say technical because that can sound pejorative, but a very specific enunciation of what the legal issue is, where it was pretty clear to all the parties what the moving parts were.
Well,
it wasn't as if they said Hawaii statute and then made a equal protection claim or something.
Yes, Your Honor. However, again, I mean, I think there's nothing jarred about the technical. Here, he certainly came forward in 2006 with a very technical argument that said, no, as a matter of fact, it's not the federal law we're talking about. We're talking about state law. And I think
let's say the trial counsel happens not to be an expert in Hawaii law, or under the theory of the defense, all 50 state law, and they've been moved around. And they need to, how do they preserve them? They just preserve by saying, I object, or do they observe by saying, I object based on Hawaii law and every possible argument that might derive from it? Are JAGS experts in Hawaii law, by the way?
I know they're not.
Is that what you're trained on at Naval Justice School?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, so how do they preserve an objection are they experts in electronic surveillance, for example?
I would assume no, Your Honor.
Okay, so my point is, how do you preserve under your theory of waiver if you don't happen to be an expert in all these things? Isn't the issue to really give fair notice to the judge and the parties what's at play?
Well, again, Your Honor, I think defense counsel at trial certainly could have seen that there was a word missing, and that doesn't take any kind of specialty in Hawaii law. And he could have, just as you could see in one place in the Constitution where it doesn't say members of the armed forces, he could have crafted a novel argument. If it doesn't say, for instance, U.S. Constitution as applied to members of the armed forces, it just says U.S. Constitution, it's not a difficult argument. Appellate defense counsel or defense counsel not being specialists in constitutional law, for them to think, well, as a matter of fact, we're not talking about the U.S. Constitution as applied to members of the armed forces, that is, that specialized body of law as applied to members of the armed forces, but rather, I mean, the U.S. Constitution as applied to civilians, and really he gets different protections here. He should have more freedoms. But that's an easy thing to see, despite not being a specialist. I think when he comes back and tries to advance a technical point of view in 2006, he's trying to have a second bite of the apple. And again, even if not, it's the law of the case because in 2004, the Navy Marine Corps court said that, no, there's basically a preemption issue. State law doesn't trump 18 U.S.C. 2511, and that was just a broad statement without reference to his specifically 182511 argument. So that's the government's position. Hopefully that clarifies the issue.
Counsel, just out of curiosity, if you had to choose between us deciding the case based on waiver or law of the case or deciding the substantive issue, which is it that you would prefer?
Well, I think the substantive issue is an easy answer, Your Honor. I think the plain language of the statute, the reference to the different constructs on how it's used, I'll get your answer more quickly. I think that all these answers, Your Honor. I'm not sure there's a preference for all of them. I think law of the case, certainly there's no manifest injustice here because we have testimony by M.W. that appellant had intercourse with his stepdaughter multiple times and fondled her, et cetera. I think there's enough evidence to show there wasn't a substantial effect. Appellant's conceding this is not a constitutional issue. He said
law of the case is a prudential doctrine, is it not?
Yes, Your Honor.
So you were arguing that you prefer that we decide this case based on a prudential doctrine, that in your view that's just as good as if we decided on the question of law?
Uh,
Are you being polite to the court, or do you really not have a view as to which theory you would think is your strongest theory?
I think we went under the substantive law, Your Honor. So I think we went under the substantive law in the plain language. You asked first if I preferred, and I thought I'd have to steal your line and say that's not what I said.
I didn't ask.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm following up.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Well, from the perspective as counsel for the United States, with a variety of responsibilities, one of which has to do with the outcome of the specific case, and the other has to do with clarity of the state of law, does the government have a preference as to which theory would be best in the interest of the United States if the court should rule in favor of the government?
Yes, Your Honor, that's an outstanding guiding question for me. I think that indeed 102 provides the tools about fairness, consistency, application. But if this is unclear to some appellants, then yes, I mean that would be the proper way to resolve this. That is the government's position, Your Honor, if it clarifies the issue like that. However, again, the government doesn't think it's unclear at all. I think it's really clear throughout the rules what this means. Very briefly, the two different ways that rules are cited, I think the court is aware of these, but I'll briefly go through them. 311 talks about the Constitution of the United States and then Act of Congress. 402 does, 501 does, and that's the first way the federal law is invoked. And the second way is the invocation of state law. 311C2, and the way that says it is the District of Columbia, state, commonwealth, possession of the United States. It's very, very clear what it's talking about, and it goes through a lengthy list of that difference island. 413 and 414, the same construct. And then, of course, the Assembly of Crimes Act, the same construct. It talks about a state, territory, possession, or district. It is clear between those two different constructs that this case is applying, or rather 317 applies the first construct. That is, you've got the Constitution of the United States, and second, an act of Congress, or rather a statute applicable to members of the armed forces in this case. Finally, if appellant's argument is followed and this court finds in his direction that absurd results would result throughout the law for courts martial. 707B, which talks about otherwise admissible evidence, it clearly means otherwise admissible at courts martial. It doesn't mean otherwise admissible at state courts or some other foreign sovereign. Certainly, the law for courts martial does not intend for polygraphs admissible at state courts to be admissible at court martials. That would make no sense. MRE 304H4B would allow evidence of an accused's refusal to submit to a body substance on any charge on which the results of a chemical analysis would have been admissible. It doesn't mean admissible at state trials. It clearly means trials at court martial. 615, the exclusion of witnesses, which is perhaps the closest analog to 317, doesn't require an appellant's implication, as he would have it, for military judges to look to state law to determine what parties may not be excluded from courts martial. I think it just says statute in that case. The language is, the rule does not authorize exclusion of a person authorized by statute to be present at court martial. That's a clear preemption issue, as is 317, and it requires only looking to federal statutes. Reading 317 is vague with regard to what Simon was talking about, where the evidence must be excluded, simply ignores the clear context of the rule and intent and the previous absurd results. The government, therefore, respectfully asks the appellant's assignment of error be denied. If there are no further questions, that concludes the government's argument.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Yes,
thank you, Your Honor. If we start from the premise that states are allowed to define privileges, that's clearly defined in MRE 501 at SEC. And then we have a privilege here that has been granted by the citizens of Hawaii, that they have a definite privacy interest related to this interest. So then I believe this court will then have to focus on the government's argument of whether the federal statute preempts this. And I don't believe it does, because there's nothing in the federal statute of itself that excludes the incorporation of a state statute. I believe the verbal play that we had about trumping can be solved by the simple explanation. If you turn to two of your children and say, do any of you want to go to pizza today? I'll go to pizza if any one of you want to go. And one child says, I do. Does that one child trump the other child? Or is it the fact that the parent looked to both sources and just saw that there was one, that one person selected that, and went with that. So we don't think, we don't agree that state law trumps a federal law. Instead, state law, the military rules of evidence, instead, much like the example, goes to two different parties and see if there is an objection. Even adopting the government's statutory construction of a unum generis fails. If we look at a unum generis, simply there is no authority for obviously statutory construction principles, but just simply citing the last Supreme Court case that applied a unum generis, that would be James Jr. versus the United States, we see that they specifically analyzed a series, I believe in that one, under a Florida statute was burglary, arson, or extortion. We have more than one example, essentially, and they analyze a specific state statute. Here, the federal government merely points to the fact that it says, I believe, the United States Constitution, and assumes that the fact, even though there's a definite or conjunction, assumes that just by one example, that would limit the interpretation of statute. A unum generis has never been interpreted to be that loose. Finally, we see that supremacy clause would exclude such ridiculous examples as adoption of foreign law. We have the fact that if this law was adopted, the president doesn't have the authority to enforce foreign laws outside of obvious SOFA agreements which are specifically considered within the rule. So instead, this rule is meant to govern third-party non-law enforcement personnel. As third-party non-law enforcement personnel that reside in a state. If that state has determined that there is a privilege of privacy, the federal government, through this rule, has an ambiguous nature such that a penalty interpretation does not fail. The government is consistently arguing the ambiguity be resolved in favor of uniformity. However, a point urges this court that is not presently the law. The law is that if there is an honest ambiguity within the rule, that it should be interpreted in favor of the service member. If the president wishes to overrule a specific right of privacy granted to an individual by the state, a point asks that he do so explicitly. Not in the general terms, not of, well, obviously he meant this. The president should be required to overturn a state-guaranteed protection explicitly. Nothing in federal law on the subject, nothing in federal law on the subject, nothing in DOJ regulation or statute or this court's prior case law interprets this rule to exclude state statutes. Because the state of Hawaii has done so, granted its citizens privacy interests, Appellant argues that Military Rule 317 should incorporate that interest when simply investigate when they conducted their investigation. Again, if this had been a military investigation, it's very simple. We don't have observed results in the fact that we would simply require a warrant, a simple judicial warrant to invade the privacy rights of this military service member. This was a warrantless, unconsensual recording that should have properly been suppressed according to the state privacy interests of Hawaii. Again, appellant argues that this court interprets such an ambiguity in favor of the service member. Absent any further questions, this concludes appellant's argument. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess until 10 a.m.
Thank you.